Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mully and Hanley, mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score, Chicago's sports station.
His speed has been terrible. Whoa. Whoa. Wow.
That's stunning. David Fay here in the booth. We just saw Phil Mickelson. This is a live look at him walking and, I guess, leaving the golf course. He's just going, I guess, going to 14T because there's Beef Johnston. I don't know that. I mean, that was stunning. And David Fay, talk us through what we just saw.
Well, that is stunning. The last time I saw something like that was at John Daly in the 99 Open at Pinehurst. They rule it's a two-stroke penalty, but that's basically his way of saying that's it. You know, no mas.
Mully and Hanley, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 The Score. And let's welcome in Mark Canizzaro, the New York Post, our fine golf writer, also covers the NFL and everything else in between. And Mark, wow. Whoa. Wow. That was a...
Baba Booey.
That was a... I mean, to call the guy the Roberto Duran of golf is... it's almost a bit much, but what are you going to do? How you doing this morning, man?
I'm doing great. How you guys doing?
We're good. We're just, you know... Poor Brooks Koepka, you know, he had to win the Open on a weekend when a guy basically ran after a moving ball. You know Phil very well. Are we changing our opinion of Phil, that dirty, rotten cheater? I don't think he was cheating. I mean, if the guy, it's not like he tried to kick a ball from under a tree with no one looking you know what I mean? Like, that was for the world to see.
Yeah, that's not cheating. That's just a classic grade A meltdown is what that was. I mean, that's just really, I mean, that, you know, it was, you know, my take on that really is that disappointed me actually more than the act itself was the explanation afterwards. You know, it's a lot of times they say the cover up is worse than the crime. Not that I think that was an egregious crime. I mean, it was a dumb thing to do, and it was clearly a loss of composure. But these things happen to, you know, everybody in sports and in life. But to stand there afterwards and kind of spin it the way he did, I just thought was a little bit weird. For our listeners who didn't hear his explanation, you know, he kind of said, oh, I knew what the rule was. I just didn't feel like going down and getting the ball. I knew it would be a two-stroke penalty, so I figured I'd just take the two-stroke penalty. You know, what he really should have said was what really was going on in his mind was that he had a brain freeze, and not even a brain freeze, he just had a, you know, he had a frustration moment, and the elements and where his round and his U.S. Open was going, finally it all kind of came crashing down on him, and he just kind of snapped for a moment there, you know, and I wish he'd said that. I had actually... Once he got back to his house that he was renting, I had a little text exchange with him right around the time when it looked like the USGA was pondering whether to DQ him or not, and he kind of clarified that he had actually reached out to Mike Davis, the executive director of the USGA, and basically told him, look, you know, I don't want to play on if I broke the rule. I should be disqualified if that's how the rule states it. And at the end of his text, he pretty much, you know, he said, you know, not my finest moment was his quote. You know, so I wish he had said that publicly to everybody right off the bat, because I think people would have understood. I mean, everybody knew that the USGA had botched the setup of the course with those couple of holes that were unplayable, 13 and 15. 13 was the one that he, you know, that he had his shenanigans on. So, but instead he kind of made that spin about, you know, just taking the two-stroke penalty on purpose, which was kind of dumb. And the reality is as the rest of the tournament unfolded, guys, when you think about it, now he took a 10 on that hole, okay, which obviously, as David Fay said, it was a no-moss moment. If he just keeps grinding it out, the way the rest of that round went, you know, I mean, the leading score at the end of Saturday was, you know, was three over par, you know. So he may still be, you know, he still has an outside shot to get himself back into that golf tournament on Sunday if he doesn't have that meltdown. And that's kind of the shame of it.
So in order, Mark, how are you going to remember this U.S. Open? For the Phil moment, for the USGA apologizing because of what happened on the course Saturday, and or Brooks Koepka actually defending his U.S. Open championship on two different courses. And as you point out, he was 7 over at one point and was flirting with not making the cut, and he just kept it all together and kept his head down and just got it done.
I think without question, this will be remembered for Brooks repeating first time since, you know, 88, 89, when Curtis Strange repeated that anybody's done it, only the seventh person in history to do it. I believe when it's all said and done, the Phil thing on Saturday will just be a footnote, as will the USGA's poor setup. This was not like 04. Now, you know, 04 at Shinnecock, the last time they played the Open there, when Retief Goosen won. That to me has been and always will be remembered for the, you know, for the USGA completely losing the golf course, particularly the seventh hole where they ended up having to water the greens, you know, between groups, which made it unfair for the guys that didn't have it watered for them, and it just kind of compromised the integrity of that competition. And subsequently afterwards, the USGA admitted that they lost the golf course. They did that on Saturday. They admitted that they lost a couple of those greens and they miscalculated what the wind was going to be, but it was not as egregious as 04. You know, to me, I always feel bad for, you know, Retief Goosen, because that 04 Open was really more remembered, you know, for that calamity. I don't think that's going to be the case in this case, particularly because, you know, we saw a little bit of history yesterday with Brooks winning two in a row. So, and you know, he also was clearly, you know, outclassed the field yesterday. I mean, there's no question about it. Yeah, really outclassed the field over the weekend, but particularly yesterday in the cauldron of the pressure, holding on to a slim lead, you know, in what were still difficult conditions with a lot of pressure. That's how I'll remember this, the U.S. Open.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we were talking earlier about the legacy of Phil Mickelson and will this affect it and that sort of thing, because that's one of the storylines. It's one of the follow-up stories people have written. And I agree with you, Mark. I felt the guy melted down. I didn't think – he also took time afterward to kind of figure out what his story was before he came in and said it. He made it sound like he was I knew if I took the two, I'd get out of there. And you know what I mean? Like it came across like he was trying to play off like he was some, I'd thought about doing this before, like some criminal genius, as opposed to a guy that just kind of lost his mind like a lot of us have on the golf course.
Yeah, no, I that's not, like I said at the top there, that was really what bothered me more about than the act itself. And he had, you know, what, six holes to think about what he was, you know, happening.
Right.
I'm sure he was embarrassed by it, and he kind of thinking about how, you know, he knows he's going to be asked about it. And, yeah, to come up with that, I'm not saying he didn't know the rule. I'm not questioning that. But, I mean, Phil, you know, Phil's a very bright guy. But I know there was some of my colleagues called for him to be, you know, that he should, you know, step away and not even play Sunday and you know, withdraw, or I think the suggestion that this is going to sully his legacy and the way people feel about him is absurd. I mean, I just think that's, you know, this is one moment. This was not a cheating moment. It was, you know, hey, listen, if anything, if the USGA and the golf, you know, governing bodies decide that, you know, this, you know, maybe they change that rule so that it is an automatic DQ if you do something like that. That's fine. But, you know, I don't think this, you know, Phil's done a lot for the game, you know. I mean, I'm not trying to be a Phil apologist in any way, because you know what he did was idiotic the other day, and he knows that, you know. But I you know, I think it's way overreaction to talk about the fact that this is going to, you know, have any sort of stain on his legacy or anything like that. I mean, you know, that I completely disagree with.
What do you make of the so-called young guns, guys like Jason Day, and Rory certainly is in this group, and I don't know if Jordan Spieth is in there, but the wildly inconsistent, you see flashes of greatness, stretches of greatness, and then they're just very pedestrian. I mean, and this group of golfers that when Tiger stepped away from injury and everything else, they kind of filled the void and people were interested in seeing them develop. Has there been enough development from that group?
Well, you know, this is going to sound almost like a, you know, I'm not trying to be trite here, but it's golf. I mean, it's, you know, I think when we've seen these guys make their runs, whether it's Spieth, I guess, in 15 and when he had that incredible year, and Jason Day in 16 when he won his first major, I might be messing my years up, but when DJ with his run, you know, to number one and all that kind of stuff, and then you see them kind of, you know, disappear for a little while. To me, to some degree, it accentuates how unbelievably great Tiger Woods was, because nobody other than Jack has had that sustained kind of excellence. And I just think that's just the nature of the game. It has nothing to do with whether they're working hard enough or committed enough or any of that kind of stuff, you know, to paint it in a broad stroke. I mean, I really think it's just golf. I mean, golf is not easy. You know, I mean, once you think you got to figure it out. I mean, look at Dustin Johnson the first 2 days of this week. When I walked out of the facility at Shinnecock on Friday night, there were not a lot of thoughts in my mind thinking that anybody was going to catch Dustin Johnson.
Right.
He kind of looked,
right,
who was behind him. You know, he looked bulletproof the first 2 days. And he took, I saw a stat last night. Actually, I think Golf Channel had a stat last night. He took he took almost 20 more putts on the weekend than he did on the first 2 days. He just, all of a sudden, just couldn't make a putt, you know? So what is that? You know, I mean, you know, maybe he got tentative, maybe he got tight. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's just kind of human nature. I thought, you know, I'll give you a good example. When you watch Spieth trying to make that cut on Friday, I mean, you know, he was way out of it, I mean, you know, from the start. And I commend him. He fought. And he blew a birdie barrage late on Friday. And all of a sudden got himself right around the cut line where he needed to come in, I think, with a couple pars on Friday. And you can almost see him tighten up and just kind of look. There was a look of angst on his face, you know, when he started missing a couple shots, a couple putts. And he ends up bogey and misses the cut. I mean, this is one of the best players in the game right now, you know. But it just shows, you know, that they're not immune to the same stuff that knuckleheads like us go through when we're trying to play a $15 Nassau on the weekend, you know. We don't want to dip into our pocket. I certainly know you guys don't. You know,
oh,
I understand from Dustin.
Yeah.
You guys do not like dipping short arms and deep pockets.
No, there's when Brian kind of pulls the wallet out, moths fly.
Yeah. My first communion money is still safe. Yeah.
Mark.
And listen, I know it. I let me tell you something. I know his brother, so I know how tight that whole program is, okay? I mean, honestly, the next time that guy buys me a beer, it'd be the first time.
Yeah.
Terry.
Yeah, well, if you want to start telling college stories, Terry's given me a few for it, so we'll save them, though.
Mark, thank you, buddy. Great catching up. That's hilarious.
Take care, Mark.
Good talking to you guys.
All right,
thanks.
Take care.
Awesome. That's Mark Canizzaro.
I can't. Now, after this weekend, I can say Phil and I have done something on the golf course.
Yeah,
the exact same thing.
There you go.
Yeah. It wasn't a 300-yard drive either.
Let me see who has better hair.
Brooks Koepka. I mean, this poor guy. He was more famous for having his girlfriend misnamed the last time he won the U.S. Open, and now he's got Phil Mickelson. Phil Mickelson, wow, on the mind.
This is like when we had Nipplegate at the Super Bowl. Okay, for a week we talked about Janet Jackson and a wardrobe malfunction, uh-huh, instead of what was a pretty darn good Super Bowl. That Super Bowl really is remembered more for that than the fact of what happened on the field.
312-644-6767 is the telephone number. It's Mully and Hanley on the Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
The Mully and Hanley Show celebrates the career of Ken Hawk Harrelson.
for all my Greek brothers and sisters, Christos Anesti, Alathos Anesti. Sacks packed with semen. George was that one year going for 400 until he got hemorrhoids at the end of death.
34 seasons in the White Sox TV booth.
He threw him out of the ballgame. You got to be faithing me. What in the hell are you doing? What are you doing, Wagner?
You can bet your sweet bippy somebody on that team's going to get drilled.
Dead! Give it!
People ask me all the time, oh, who are the most generous athletes? And right away I tell them, jockeys.
He got hit with a foul tip in a personal area.
Everything's good. Watching a lot of Walker, Texas Ranger, and sipping a little Smirnoff, you know.
Bob, welcome, buddy.
Hi, pal. Your nose, every year I see you, gets a little heavier.
Here's Mully and Hanley's favorite Hawk Harrelson moment from yesterday's broadcast.
Hell yeah! Hell yeah!
You know, we're in one of those streaks now. And you know, baseball is a contagious. Everything's contagious in baseball and streaks. We're in one of those streaks right now that every time we walk a guy, it seems like he scores. Every time there's a close pitch, it goes the other way.
Mully and Hanley, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 to the score. Hawk is, he was on his game like you've never seen, Brian. There was so many glorious moments in that game between Hawk and Frank Thomas, Big Frank. Greatest Sox hitter to a lot of us. Best White Sox player I ever saw play. Frank Thomas sitting with Hawk. Obviously, they got a very close relationship, and there was a lot of warmth there. And it was funny because at one point they started talking about Ozzie Guillen. They had a couple different conversations about Ozzie. But at one point, Hawk was saying he started talking about Ozzie and Frank having an argument. And I thought of you because you were there.
Yeah,
and
you
tell that story. Let's take a listen to this exchange between Hawk and Frank about Ozzie.
One of the funniest things I've seen in my whole White Sox career happened in Baltimore. You and Ozzie got into an argument during batting practice.
Many times.
I want to tell you something. I was sitting up in the booth, and it was nobody versus nobody in the stands, and I could hear every word that was going on. I have never laughed harder because Ozzie was right up against your chest looking straight up. It looked like he was looking at a skyscraper.
Ozzie and Joey Cora.
And you were just looking down on him smiling.
Their job was just to irritate me every day, I tell you that much. And they didn't like me being happy. They wanted me to be angry because they always say, when I'm playing angry, I'm at my best. So Joey and Ozzie took upon themselves every day to make me angry.
I tell you what.
It worked, I tell you that much. I'm very thankful of those two.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that Joey really was an asset to you hitting.
Oh, yeah.
Because of all the pitches he took and everything else, you got a chance to see the stuff. He gone.
You know, Joey was, like I said, I'm shocked he hasn't been a manager yet. His baseball IQ is tremendous. You see his brother Alex now, the head. He's the manager of the Boston Red Sox now. But Joey's going to continue on. And one day he's going to get a managing job. He's a big-time baseball man. He knows what he's doing out there.
Well, what amazes me is Ozzie's not managed.
Oh, of course.
I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it really is. That man was so responsible.
Exactly.
For 05.
I hope it happens for him.
I do, too. You know, and baseball needs guys like Ozzie. He made a mistake, okay?
Right, he did.
We all make mistakes.
We talked about it. I'll be honest with you. When, you know, Kenny came in and Jerry said Ozzie was going to be your manager, I was like, are you lost your mind? And I'll be darned, it worked out. He knew my strength and my weaknesses. He knew what days I needed off. It was amazing to play for him because, you know, I played very well as him as my manager because he knew me. And spending 11 years as a teammate, he had a clue of what type of pitcher I shouldn't be facing and, you know, certain days of the week that I needed off. So hats off to that. And that's why, you know, Ozzie won a World Series so fast.
Well, to me, he was, if you're talking about baseball acumen and sports acumen, he was comparable to is that ball hit well in the center field, but right at him. So two down, but Ozzie was comparable to guys like Michael Jordan and Larry Bird. They knew where everybody on the court was at any time.
Well,
Ozzie knew what was going on that baseball field, everything at any time.
Yes, he did. And in the stands, too. That's what was great about it. Well. He could watch the stands, he could watch the field, but he knew every out on the field. He knew where everyone was located. He had his baseball IQ was through the roof.
Yeah. Well, somebody, it's going to take It's going to take a general manager that's got some guts.
Yes.
To hire him because I've talked with some general managers. In fact, I've called a couple of them. They had called me and said they were thinking about making a change and asked me to give them a short list of some people I knew. Every time I put Ozzie right at the top.
Just great stuff.
Yeah, I flipped over right in the middle of some of that the stuff with Ozzie in particular. And Ozzie, yeah. Ozzie's the first one to tell you. He knew what was going on in the fifth row of the box seats behind the dugout. Is he'd spend half the game talking to people or looking and all that. But, yeah, this Sunday TV stuff with Hawk has become must-see TV. And
oh, it's fantastic.
So I was flipping back and forth between watching the U.S. Open and getting more of this.
Ozzie was comparable to guys like Michael Jordan and Larry Bird.
I always think of those three together.
There's so much. It was such a great broadcast. And if you're a Sox fan, there was so much there. Let's take a listen to the Love Fest. Let's take a listen to Hawk praising Frank early on, and then to Frank later on really praising Hawk. I think that's fun stuff. So let's start with Hawk praising Frank.
Let me give our viewers a little bit about Frank Thomas. First of all, he's got a memory like an elephant. He doesn't forget a thing. He can probably right now talk as much about baseball as anybody you'll ever see. And he can slice and dice a game as well as anybody you'll ever talk to. He studied the game. He knew how to hit. And as I've said, you've heard me say many times, Frank is one of the four greatest right-handed hitters I have ever seen. And not so much in order, but the other three were Albert Pujols, Manny Ramirez, and Miguel Cabrera.
It's great company, Hulk.
That's pretty
I'm honored.
Exclusive club right there.
I'm honored.
There's another club.
I tell you.
And here's another club that's pretty exclusive as well. One of only four guys to have a 300 or better average, 500 or more home runs, 1,500 or more RBIs, 1,000 runs, and 1,500 walks. And look at this. The other, Babe Ruth, Ted Williams, and Mel Ott. Now, Frank is the only right-handed hitter among that group, which makes it even more unbelievable.
You're making me blush. I'm telling you, Hawk. Got to stop it.
You never blushed in your life.
I'm over here blushing. Oh, that's amazing.
It is amazing.
It is. I know
you think back sometimes on your career.
I just stay humble with it. I just don't like to really think about it. I just think I was blessed out here to play the game that I love so much and play it the right way and give it everything I had. But as for the accolades, they are better when you retire. You know, you sit back and take a look at all that stuff. And this has been fantastic today, Hulk, sharing this booth with you. And I'm going to say it now. I'm going to embarrass you, but I'm just going to say it. You belong in the Hall of Fame, my friend. And it's just a matter of time before it happens. Because your calls will historically be remembered. And I hear people day in and day out using them on all their sports shows and their talk shows. That's saying a mouthful right there. There's a lot of respect out there for the Hulk, man. Thanks for having me in the booth with you today, Hulk.
It's my pleasure.
I'm honored. I really am.
I'm honored because I'll tell you why. This guy right here, in case you youngsters don't know, is the greatest hitter in White Sox franchise history. And he has done things, I said it before, and I'll say it again, and I'll continue to say it. For the first 7 years he was in this league, he was the greatest right-handed hitter I ever saw.
Well, let me tell you something. A lot of people don't know. The long nights after those 0-for-4s and 0-for-3s, that you would come on those plane trips and sit there and talk to me for 30, 40 minutes at a time about hitting, it's priceless. And I got so much out of that, and I was able to break out a lot of slumps because you took the time to do that.
Well, you know, and they all were not nice.
No, they weren't. They were not.
We had some.
Trust me, I was stubborn at times, and you broke it down quite a few. That's okay. I respected it, and I enjoyed it, and you helped me through a lot of tough times. Thank you.
You got him picked off.
We got one.
Make it one throw. There you go.
Caught him napping. Not going to outrun Tim Anderson, even though Jacoby Jones can really fly.
So that'll be a caught stealing.
We closed the book on James Shields for the afternoon.
As I said earlier, James Shields, when he goes out there to that mound, he's going to give you everything he's got. And, you know, he reminds me a lot of Black Zach McDowell.
Yes.
James, good major league pitchers. If you got to have your good stuff and your good control every day, you're not going to win a whole bunch of games in the major leagues. You got to learn how to win when you don't have your good stuff and you don't have your good control. And that's where Black Jack was so effective.
Superior.
I texted Dustin and I said, this was a beautiful moment between the two of them. And then they ruined it by comparing James Shields.
That's Black Jack McGill.
Yeah.
You're making me blush. I'm telling you, Hawk.
Oh, that was so much fun. If you're a Sox fan, there were so many stories. Even if you're a Cub fan, they talked about Lou Piniella, which was really funny. I got to tell you, that broadcast was phenomenal. And you're right, Brian. Those are games you really want to just, you know, sit down, hunker down, and strap it on and watch. You know what's funny is he's so right, Frank Thomas. I there are so many Hawkisms that go through my head whenever I'm watching baseball. Like, I will, like, you know, can of corn. Like, I will kind of just listen to the game in with Hawk's voice in my head.
Sure.
That's how long I've been listening.
We got one of those yesterday.
Yeah, it was great.
Frank has improved on the air a lot since going to Fox
over the last
couple of seasons. Yeah. And some people that may have missed it, on Friday the White Sox announced some of the upcoming guests. On August 19th, it'll be Paul Konerko. That'll be wonderful. And on September 2nd, it'll be AJ in the Red Sox game. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. You know, I love Hawk and Stoney. I love listening to the broadcast. But it's special when he's talking to players like that because of the rapport he had with Frank. That was genuine stuff. And Hawk does belong in the Hall of Fame, whether anyone wants to sneer at that or not.
The Frick Award has got to be in his future, right?
Sure, you would imagine.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
I think I fit really well. I mean, there's a lot of really good pieces. I know a lot of the players. A few work out with my trainers, so I've gotten to know a lot of them. Bobby, Denzel. I've known Antonio since high school. I know all about Lowry's game. I know a lot of these guys, and I think I have a really good feel for them.
Molly and Hanley, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. That is the voice of Trey Young. He worked out with the Bulls last week, and I think that was last Thursday or Wednesday, whatever. And then on Friday, they ended up attending a workout with Michael Porter Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And the draft, the NBA draft, is on Thursday. And the Bears have no picks in the NBA draft. What a shocker. The Bulls pick 7th and 22nd, I believe. Are there two first-rounders? The 22nd pick they got in the Nico trade. And there could be a player down there. You know, you can find a player in the draft if you do your homework. But certainly they need to find a player at number 7. And there's a lot of talk about how dynamic a player they need. And the idea being that, you know, Wendell Carter just bores everyone. Mikal Bridges, boring pick. These could be good players, but there's arguments about how good, what the, you're talking about floors and ceilings. These are guys with pretty high floors, don't know about how high the ceiling is. And that's what you're looking for, especially in an NBA team, because the players are so tall. But, Ryan, I would say that this is an opportunity for the Bulls to really improve their roster. It's one they've been looking forward to. There are a lot of different possibilities. Increasingly, Trae Young seems to be a person that people have evaluated going to the Bulls.
Yep.
Now there's a question of whether he'd even be there.
You know, he reminds me a lot of Black Jack McDowell.
Yes, and Michael Jordan and Larry Bird.
Oh, my God.
And interesting, because you said basketball players normally very tall, and we've established that Trae Young is not that.
No, he's 5'11",
he's
maybe?
He's 6'3"
Man, he's 5'10" then?
And Joe Colley just came out with a column in the Sun-Times Sunday saying, you know, basically to borrow a Dustin, anything but you, anything but anyone but Trae Young.
Yeah.
And he said, here's some scouting notes, compares pretty well to Steph Curry, has unlimited range, seems to be a threat to make a shot as soon as he crosses half court. The biggest concern is on the defensive end, and rightfully so. A lack of high-end athletic ability really hurts him. And it says those would be right out of the scouts' notebooks. Not for Trae Young, but for Jimmer Fredette, going back to 2011 when the Milwaukee Bucks used the 10th overall pick. And we, you know, we had texters saying that, I think it was Thursday when we were talking about Trae Young, that he does, in fact, equal this year's Jimmer Fredette. And I kind of scoffed at that. But, I mean, the dots are being connected. It seems to be more and more momentum, and certainly talk about the Bulls and Trae Young being the match. But Boy, does that scare you? And if it does, should it scare you? And it does scare me to a large degree, but it's not the wing they were looking for. But again, the seventh overall pick wasn't what they were looking for either. So, I mean, Joe basically said, like Jimmer Fredette, Trae Young's going to have a better career in China than he does in the NBA. I mean, we talk about burying a guy.
Wow.
Our guy Joe Colley.
Petty.
Didn't pull any punches here. He just said that this is not going to work out well for the Chicago Bulls if they end up doing this.
It's interesting. KC broke it down five bigs and five wings, and I think that's a fair way of kind of projecting it. I like the idea. You know, DeAndre Ayton's going to be gone, right? Marvin Bagley will be gone. Jaren Jackson will be gone. Will Mo Bamba be there? And how does that do anything for you if he is? And then the other big is Wendell Carter Jr. And you know, again, you're talking about a guy that has kind of a limited floor. I don't know how big the ceiling is on that one. In terms of the wings, you know, Michael Porter Jr. might have been the first or second pick in this draft had he not been injured, but he comes pre-injured. He comes with a bad back. Now, there have been plenty examples of NBA players that have come into the league with issues and with problems. And, you know, Joel Embiid, you've waited a couple of years to see him. You know, I don't know how you feel about Kyrie Irving, but he was hurt pretty much at Duke his only year there. I think you saw him again. He went down, and then I think you saw him again in the NCAA tournament, but they didn't have much of a run. He was trying to fit in with the team. Now you look at Kyrie, would you be happy to have him, or do you say, well, he's an injured player who was injured again this year? 11 college games total for Kyrie Irving. So I don't know if you got enough of a view. How many did Michael Porter Jr. end up playing? It's like three, right? Or is it something
so
like that?
So if you're going to jump up a few spots to get one of those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you willing to pay? Because you're going to certainly both first round picks, right? Is that it? 7 and 22 to get you to 4, get you to 5. Do you have to throw something?
Is that all it takes?
No, you have to throw something else in there too, right? You have to throw a body or a future pick, right?
Campaign. Can you make that call? Hey, we'll throw Campaign in. What did you say?
Then you really need.
What did you just say?
Then you really need a guard. Yeah.
I said that we could give you a Campaign.
And then we'll need. Yeah. Oh, hello?
Hello. Hello. Okay.
Yeah. Then we're going to need your first round pick for the next 4 years, too. You're going to need a sweetener.
But we have identified a group of players that will most likely be gone when the Bulls pick. And I think the uncertainty of Trae Young, the uncertainty of Michael Porter Jr. And again, you know, because you're picking seventh, if you want a wow impact player, you're going to have to give away something, whether it's, you know, the guy comes pre-injured or the guy comes, you know, pre-shrunk. I think you've got a little bit of an issue that you're going to have to surrender one way or another, right?
And would you be better off, since seventh is no man's land, to keep the 22nd pick and hope that you get a player out of one of the two? You double your chances of finding a player there. Or do you do package them up, move up incrementally, and hope to, you know, to God you get something resembling a star?
I mean, it seems like we offered three options. One, you know, pull out all the stops and throw anything you have to throw
at San Antonio.
San Antonio to get Kawhi Leonard. The other one was figure out how to move up a short distance if you really fall in love with someone. Maybe try to get to 5 or try to get to 4 or 3, whatever it might be, in order to make some kind of an impact out of the draft. And then the third option was just, you know,
sit chilly
and see what comes to you and make a decision when you're on the board. And that's maybe the hardest one of all, because what if those guys are gone while other guys could move down? You know, you just have to. It's very difficult when you pick where they pick. You should get a good player, but I don't know that you're going to get a great impact.
Well, that's the problem. And, you know, yeah, you need great at some point.
Yeah, and you know, again, Kawhi Leonard comes pre-great. But does he come for long term? He has to if you're giving up as much as they'd ask. And are you willing to give up Lauri Markkanen if that's what they're demanding in a trade like that? It seems And I mean, it would be Markkanen, two picks this year and a pick next year, probably. They're looking for a lot. And where do you draw the line on what you'd give up?
And I know they don't want to trade Kawhi Leonard in the conference. But if it ends up being the best offer on the table by far, aren't they going to trade him within the conference?
Yeah, I think they're going to try to get the best deal they can for their team. My question is just with the Bulls, do you want to get back to playing the role of Jimmy Butler as Kawhi Leonard? I mean, how much better are you as a team? How much do you have? Does that help you attract somebody down the line? What's his situation? Where is he at mentally, physically?
All the stuff you have to sort through and figure out.
All the little issues that come into play in life, and hopefully you do all that homework, and let's see. It's Monday. You got till Thursday. 312-644-6767 is the number. We're going to have a little bit of transition when we come back. We'll talk to the lads. They are out and about, and we will bring them in next. Mully and Hanley on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.